Hello, everybody. This is Tim, and this is the Honor Roll. Welcome back, all listeners. I was doing this a couple years ago. I had a ton of fun doing it. And then I've taken the last year or year and a half probably off from doing this. I've still kept up on new horror movies, but it's been a little bit tougher. I've got a one-year-old at home, so it's a little bit tougher for me to sit down and record my thoughts a lot of the time. So this fell by the wayside, but it was something that I really, really enjoyed doing, and I want to bring it back. I can't promise it's going to be regular. This is a way for me to force myself to keep up with new horror movies and take chances in what I watch as well. So not just watch the big stuff or the stuff everybody says is good, but to maybe throw on a Tubi original every once in a while and take a risk. Part of the reason I also brought this back is I've been putting together weekly release videos on YouTube, taking a look at what's coming out that week in horror movies, and I've been posting them to YouTube and just kind of teaching myself and reteaching myself making videos. And they're still pretty basic right now, but thank you to anybody that's watched them. And I'm doing it kind of as a public service announcement as well, or public service as well, because I know it's tough to keep up with a lot of new horror movies and when they're coming out. But I've been doing it and I go, man, I kind of want to watch that one, or I want to see what that is all about. So my plan is not to do this. This is not going to be, I believe when I did this before, it was kind of on a regular basis. I try to do it every week, every 2 weeks. But this is what I'm going to do here. Is anytime I have watched five new horror movies that have come out in 2024, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to talk about them. And these aren't going to be straight up reviews. By the time I watch a lot of these movies, because I don't get a chance to get out to theaters, I catch a lot of the stuff on VOD or streaming. I don't think a straight up review is even necessary. But what the Honor Roll is, it's just a list of movies that, so I sit down, I watch five movies, and then I pick the ones that I think will make the top 10 or have a chance to make my top 10 at the end of the year. That's what the Honor Roll is, what it was. It might be one movie per episode. It might be no movies per episode. It might be all five movies per episode that make the Honor Roll, but I think you get the idea. That's the goal. That's the goal, is to kind of narrow down to a group of movies that I can pick my top 10 from at the end of the year. And it's just a fun way for me to keep up with new horror movies. This week, my first week back, is interesting batch on this episode. I watched a movie with a connection to an all-time great film that, while it wasn't the worst movie I've ever seen, it did cause me to give up on the filmmakers behind it. On the positive side of things, I also watched one of my favorite movies of the year. I also watched a movie that caused me to want to dive in deep a little bit to the soft numbers at the box office for horror movies so far in 2024. And maybe talk some fans off the ledge, some horror fans off the ledge, because I've seen it a little bit. So let's dive into this. Let's dive into the Honor Roll. You know what? I thought I wanted to start somewhere else. I want to start with Night Swim, though. And I don't actually wanted to start with the movie itself right away. This played in theaters. This, I believe, was the first horror movie of the year in 2024. It played theaters. It's on Peacock right now. It did okay at the box office. I don't want to say it did bad. I mean, it made like $51 million worldwide, $35 million, I believe around 30-something million, the exact number. Oh, $32 million at the box office domestically with a $15 million budget. This is a Blumhouse movie. It certainly wasn't a bomb, but I remember people calling it a box office letdown, a box office disappointment, or underwhelming at the box office. And so far in 2024 for horror at the box office, that seems to be a common theme among some of the wider release movies. So with Abigail coming out and underwhelming a little bit this past week, I wanted to sit down and look, compare it to last year and see where we're sitting. And I also kind of maybe want to talk some people off the ledge, because what I've seen going around the horror sphere, social media, I've seen a couple people in particular that have a wider reach kind of saying, you have to get out to support this movie or studios are going to stop making horror movies, essentially, or pull back on horror movies. And I don't know if I agree. I've seen it pop up in some of the bigger outlets. I think Deadline or Variety had a story on it. I've seen the same idea. I think that's I think that's taking things a little too far. So let's do this. Let's take a look at the first 4 months of 2023. We're going to compare quarters, 2023 and 2024. So 2023 saw the release in January of Megan and Fear. Fear made $2 million. So that was nothing compared to, actually, that's the lowest on the list I have, including 2024. Now, Megan, on the other hand, was a huge hit for Blumhouse and ended up being the third highest grossing horror movie of 2023 with $95 million. So that is kind of throwing things out of whack compared to 2024. February, we had Knock at the Cabin, which made around $35 million. So a solid grossing film. Scream 6 in March was another big one, making $108 million at the box office. So in the first quarter of 2023, we have two movies that ended up being in the top three grossing horror movies of the year and some of the top grossing movies of the year, period. And the only movie that would beat it was Five Nights at Freddy's, which came out later in the year. So there we go. That's from March. And then compared to April, which is where we are now, but year over year, Renfield came out and underwhelmed, and I'll get a little bit more into the underwhelming performance of the Universal Monster related movies at the box office in the past year or two, which is a bummer, honestly. But that made $17 million. The Pope's Exorcist, the Russell Crowe movie, only made $20 million. Now, another decent hit was Evil Dead Rise, which made $67 million. So there you go. For the first 4 months of 2023, the straight ahead horror movies made around $344 million at the box office. So quite a bit. I think that accounted for, I think, about a third of the box office overall, as far as horror movies go, that last year. Now, let's take a look at this year, 2024. January, we already talked about Night Swim, made about $32 million domestically, $51 million worldwide. I'm focusing on domestic for purposes here. February, we saw Lisa Frankenstein. That came out and only made $9 million. That was a bit of a bummer. March, we had Imaginary from Blumhouse, which I think they were kind of hoping. It obviously wasn't going to do Megan numbers for Blumhouse, because that was a phenomenon, and that got good reviews. Imaginary did not. I think that's something to take into account here as well when we're looking at a lot of these movies were not reviewed well. A lot of those movies last year were. But Imaginary only at about $27 million. Immaculate, that was a nice hit. That made around $15 million against a $9 million budget. Same thing with Late Night with the Devil, which is around $9 million in theaters. I've read that budget was around $1 million, but that's not a confirmed number. And now we're in April. The First Omen, as of right now, has only made $18 million. And Abigail came out this past week, as of this recording, and was only sitting around $11 or $12 million. So a letdown, a disappointment. In some ways, still, though, you have to take into account budget. So these aren't huge bombs or anything, but they are, the numbers are soft. I think that's a good way to put it. Right now, we're sitting at $121 million for these horror movies in 2024. Now, here's where I start to talk some people off the ledge a little bit. We talked about the big releases of 2023. It was a bit front-loaded with the second and third highest-grossing horror movies of the year that came out in January through March with Scream 6 and Megan. We still have, on the horror side of things, some big releases to come this year. And if we're looking at hitting 100 million, like those movies did or almost did, there are a couple that can do it. The Watchers isn't one of them. This is the Ishana Shyamalan movie that will be out in a couple weeks. But I could see this one making a decent, like, $20 to $30 million range against a budget like that. This could be a sleeper hit. One that I do think might have a chance at cracking that 100 million, if that's what we're looking at as a barrier, A Quiet Place Day One. The first one made $188 million. The second one, $160 million. So that one could be up around at least a Scream 6 level. We also have Trap coming out. This is the M. Night Shyamalan movie. His movies have kind of been on the downtick since Split, which made $138 million. Then Glass came out, made $111 million. Old sat around $48. Knock at the Cabin, we mentioned, was about $35. I do think the trailer had some decent buzz. I think it's a great concept. I think people responded well to the trailer. I think this might sit in the middle of old and knock around $40 million, but that's okay. I can't imagine, I haven't looked up the budget, I can't imagine it being huge on that. But that's another mid-size hit. Now, another one that could conceivably break that $100 million barrier comes out later this summer, Alien Romulus. Covenant made around $74 million, but I think people were a little exhausted. I don't want to say exhausted, or just uninterested. And I like Covenant a lot, but I think general audiences were a little uninterested at the time in another Alien movie. We've had a couple of years. This also has the Disney machine behind it now, marketing machine, which Romulus did, or Covenant did not. Covenant made around $74 million. I could see Alien creeping around that $100 million mark as well. One more movie that has a shot at breaking that $100 million barrier. And by the way, this is not, $100 million is not automatic success or anything like that, or anything under is not a failure. I'm just using it as kind of a baseline to show how all hope is not lost in terms of horror at the box office. But Smile 2 is another one that was, the first one was a sleeper hit. It made over $100 million. Sequels tend to do less most of the time with horror sequels. So this is an outside shot, but the first one did it. So maybe Smile 2 could do the same thing. I'm doing this because I have a couple of points I want to make here. The idea that studios are going to give up on horror movies is quite frankly silly to me. Studios have never given up on horror movies. Horror movies have been around since the dawn of studios. Universal, which we've talked about a couple times here, has built their studio on the backs of these classic monsters. It's why they keep revisiting them. And it's why I'm kind of bummed that Abigail, Renfield, movies like that, they haven't taken off with general audience. It's been a while since Invisible Man did, but the classic monsters have been really, really underwhelming at the box office. And yes, that is a bummer because, as I mentioned, Universal is, it owes a lot to that group of classic monsters. Now, will these studios pull back? Maybe. But to that point, as you can see, especially now post-pandemic, studios need these mid-budget movies. Not every movie hits and does gangbusters business. The smaller budget movies like horror not hitting is a much softer blow than a big, huge summer blockbuster bombing. And yeah, studios are looking for movies like Megan or Smile that are made for a lower budget and then just catch fire for whatever reason, whether it be viral marketing, whatever reason, those movies did gangbusters. So also, yeah, they might pull back a little. That's how things go. Horror is cyclical. We have to remember that. And we have been in the midst of a boom period for horror at the box office theatrically. And I think we're going to realize that in a few years looking back on this time period. They don't last forever. And that's okay. One of the reasons Willie and I started doing this podcast that we do was to look back on those so-called dead periods in horror and find that there was still some great stuff being made. Hell, Candyman was a wide-release horror movie, an all-time classic, and it came out in the early 90s, which is considered a wasteland for horror movies. And you can see, that's not always true. We're going to be okay. There's still going to be some great stuff getting made somewhere, whether it's in theaters, on demand, streaming, whatever. Seek it out, support it, champion what you love. I love movies, and I love following the business of movies as well. It's interesting to me. But how much a movie makes doesn't determine how much I like a movie or what movies I love. And you know what? Not everyone loves horror movies, and we could be seeing general audiences maybe moving away from horror. And you know what? That's fine. Horror isn't for everybody. That's part of why we love it. All right, so let's talk about Night Swim. I liked this movie a lot more than I thought I would. The reviews were, we'll say, mediocre. When Night Swim works for me, it feels, well, kind of like a mediocre Stephen King short story in a lot of ways. The King short stories I'm thinking of are like The Mangler, the demonically possessed laundry machine. This, I'm going to be honest with you, I thought of The Mangler a lot during this movie. There's that one, the one King short story where it's got the finger in the drain, it's sticking out of the drain. There's like a Family Guy bit. I think it's Family Guy. Yeah, it's Family Guy where they have a Stephen King pitch an idea about a killer lamp. It's really not that much of a parody, to be honest. But you know what? That was part of Night Swim's charm for me. But there's also, when it comes to King references, if you will, baseball references throughout. He's the lead character in this, Wyatt Russell, is a former baseball player for the Brewers. Yeah, the Milwaukee Brewers. I don't think this makes the Brewers organization look real great. And this guy goes down, and they are forced to like, he gets like injured, or he's stricken. He can't play baseball anymore, and like the Brewers don't seem to help him out at all with his medical bills. They're like relying on his wife's teacher insurance. That's, boy, maybe this is made by people who hate the Milwaukee Brewers and want to make them look bad. That's fine. Listen, it's the Brewers. Nobody cares. Also, as I mentioned, one of the characters is a teacher. Very, very much a King trademark. The family dynamics, a man that feels almost helpless or neutered in his own mind, at least, trying to get back and be the man of the house. I liked all that stuff. There are a couple of great, I won't say great, there's one really good scene. And what's funny is this movie is called Night Swim, and the night scenes are too murky visually at times. The best scene in this movie is actually a daytime scene. It's the kid looking at the quarters. I won't say much else. It also takes itself very seriously, which is both a positive and a negative. A positive because I think it adds to the silliness of the movie that it takes itself that seriously. It also drags in times because it's so straight-faced. But you know what? I think I'd rather commit to the bit, if you will. I like, as I mentioned, I like this more than I thought I would. Great Loden Wainwright's the swimming song Needle Drop in this movie cracked me up. A couple of moments cracked me up. It's not on the honor roll. I didn't like it that much, but you know what? Maybe if I saw this in theaters, I'd be a little harsher on it, but I watched this on Peacock. And you know what? It's not a bad streaming movie. So there you go. Not a bad PG-13 horror movie. Will I ever watch it again? No. Probably not, unless we do it on the podcast. But there you go. Night Swim, not on the honor roll. All right, I went longer than I thought I would on Night Swim, so let's jump over to Frogman. This is a movie, it's a found footage movie. I've seen quite a few of these in recent years, right? Not so much on the big screen, but smaller movies. The VHS movies, the Hell House movies, Horror in the High Desert was one I caught up with, the two of those. Skinamarink was really a found footage movie. It's been a quiet comeback for found footage because we aren't getting the mainstream, the bigger budget, bigger releases, I should say, found footage movies. But on the indie level, yeah, it's been, and honestly, I've liked a lot of them. And it's made me realize that, yeah, I kind of like found footage movies. Three friends in search of the Loveland Frogman find out that he is more than just a local legend. This is directed by Anthony Cousins. It's also written by him and John Carsco. This is okay. It takes probably 40 minutes to really get going. There's a lot of time spent on a couple of things. We get a ton of setup on the backstory of the Frogman, which is okay. I thought it was a little bit repetitive at times. The other thing that was repetitive is we get a lot of time with the town, backstory of the town as well. And listen, characters in found footage movies that I personally find a little bit annoying, it's kind of a trademark. It's kind of a hallmark of the subgenre. I think it's also the biggest flaw in this movie. It spends too much. There's a relationship between two of the leads. They hooked up at one point in their life. These people, though, they're like in their 20s or 30s. Who gives a shit? They hooked up and they don't want to be together for some reason, or like they can't be together. Like, I don't. That's the thing, is I don't remember. They don't really care. I don't care. The Frogman is out there. We know he's out there. You keep talking about how sweet he is. Why do I care if you had sex with each other? If my two best friends hooked up, first of all, I would go, that's a surprise. I've known you for years. I didn't see this coming. But then I would go, you know what? We got a Frogman to catch. I want to see the Frogman. And here's the thing. Here's what the Frogman is. This is from a sighting that I pulled from Wikipedia, the most reliable source. The animal, the Frogman, was fully illuminated in his vehicle's headlights, and he described it as 3 to 4 feet long and about 50 to 75 pounds with leathery skin. He reported spotting the animal crouched like a frog before it momentarily stood erect to climb over the guardrail and back down towards the river. This is the Frogman that we are missing out on, because I got to hear about these two people getting drunk and having 2 minutes of passion together. Anyway, the last stretch of this movie, though, is pretty solid. The Frogman looks sweet as hell, but that's part of the issue once we get to him. And this is not a long movie, but man, the first 30 or 40 minutes, we got to get through this a little bit. It feels like it should have been a short, but whatever. I feel like I've crapped all over this movie, but I actually, you know what? It's not bad. It's a rental. Right now, I did rent this. Maybe that's why I spent money on this, and maybe that's why I'm being a little bit harsher than I mean to, but you know what? Keep an eye out for this. Keep an eye out for Frogman when it hits like Tubi, or one, if you subscribe to one of those streaming services, probably on Prime or something. I don't think it's a bad hour and 15 minutes, and you know what? The Frogman is pretty cool. I just wish we got to see a little more of him, that's all. Not on the honor roll, but not awful. All right, Festival of the Living Dead. Oh, yeah. All right, while attending a festival to commemorate the original zombie attack, Ash and her friends encounter the Living Dead and must fight back or be devoured. This is directed by the Soska sisters. I'll get to them a little later. As I think did the plot say, the Night of the Living Dead connection here, they are this Ash person and one other person. They are the, I think the granddaughter. Ash is the granddaughter of Ben from the original Night of the Living Dead. I don't know how that works. Spoilers for Night of the Living Dead. I guess maybe before the events of the movie. I don't know. I feel like he would have mentioned it. Anyway, Night of the Living Dead. There are a lot of remakes, sequels, whatever. The reason for this is because it's public domain. Here's what happened. This is a funny, like, independent horror movie, like, old-timey, just only could happen in the film business. But distributor Walter Reed, they insisted on a title change. It was originally called Night of the Flesh Eaters. They wanted it to be Night of the Living Dead so it could avoid confusion with a 1964 movie called The Flesh Eaters. And then they deleted the original title card from the film, but they also deleted the copyright notice. So that means, what that means is Night of the Living Dead has been public domain since its first showing. You can do whatever you want with it. You can remake it. You can make sequels to it. This also means John Russo, who co-wrote it, and George Romero, the director and co-writer, they did not receive any money. And that led to differences between them. And so at some point, I believe about a decade later, John Russo wrote a novel called Return of the Living Dead, which got made into a feature called by, is it Dan O'Bannon? Almost blanked there for a second. That was also called Return of the Living Dead. Now, his novel, the novel is a little bit more serious. Dan O'Bannon's movie is a riot, but it's also a straight up comedy. So that is one kind of branch off from Night of the Living Dead. And we've had quite a few, and I'm just going to focus on the night ones because I don't even want to get into the Dawn branches here. But that's there are four sequels, I believe, to Return of the Living Dead. There's part two, there's part three, and then there's Necropolis and Rave from the Grave. One of my favorite titles, Return of the Living Dead, Rave from the Grave. So he also, Russo, at some point, he I think it was like the late 90s, he did a 30th anniversary edition of the film, and he put in 15 minutes of new footage that he shot, and he removed 15 minutes of old footage. He even brought back Bill Hinsman. Now, Hinsman, Willie and I did Flesh Eater, this movie I'm going to talk about here. He directed, but we never got a proper pronunciation, so I'm just going to go with Hinsman, because that's what it looks like to me. But he made a movie called Flesh Eater that came out in the 80s. It was directed by Bill Hinsman, and it follows that cemetery zombie, that first one from Night of the Living Dead. Part of that movie was edited in to this anniversary edition of Night of the Living Dead. But that's not it. We also have sequels. There was like a movie called Children of the Living Dead that came out in 2001 that Russo produced with Tom Savini was in it. I have not seen this one. I'm going to be honest, I've only seen a couple of these, but that was supposed to be a sequel to, I think, Night and Return. There was a remake that came out in 1990. This was the one that was directed by Tom Savini. This one I like a lot. This has Tony Todd. I think this is my favorite of the Night of the Living Dead related films. One of my not favorites is Night of the Living Dead 3D. This was the one with, I believe, Sid Haig was in this one. this one is kind of, it's a 3D remake that was, because remember, if you, around that time, 3D was all the rage in this. They remade it because guess what? They could. It's public domain, no copyright. You can do whatever you want. That one had a sequel called Reanimation. I've seen the 3D one. It's awful. The first one, it's really terrible. Not worth watching. There were also animated remakes. Night of the Living Dead, I think it was just called Animated. Then there was Darkest Dawn. Tony Todd did a voice in that. And I believe Tom Sizemore and Joe Pilato were in that as well. So as you can see, Night of the Living Dead, due to its public domain status, has had quite the history in terms of sequels, remakes, whatever. So I guess this falls into the sequel group. Or like this, I guess, is an attempt at a Lego sequel, I would say. I don't know. This is not a good film. This is a Tubi original. I watched another Tubi original I'll talk about a little later. This has characters, and I'm not one that says characters has to be like, all characters have to be likable. The characters in this make a choice that is so insane to me. So they get in a car accident in the woods. Their friend is left behind, and then they go, okay, we've got to go. They're on their way to this festival, this music festival. And they go, okay, we're going to go there and get help. We're going to go there and get help and then bring help back to you. And so they get there, and then like 10 minutes later, I'm watching it, and I realize they're just enjoying the festival, doing drugs and watching the music. And I thought to myself, isn't there a band that I personally would do this for? And I don't think there is. Maybe like if they reanimated Prince and he was back, maybe I'd go see Prince live. But you know what? I would say, even then, I think my friends would understand if I left them dying in the woods to go see Prince, the reanimated corpse of Prince performing live. So from there on, I was just like, I'm not in these people's camp. I hope they get eaten by zombies, to be honest. And that's fine. But where the movie has to deliver is in the gore department and in the zombie mayhem department. And this movie does not do that, unfortunately. This is where I should talk about the Soska sisters, because I was a big fan of their earlier work. American Mary is one that sticks out to me, and I thought they had a voice that would last. And I'm just going to be honest with you, I don't think they do. It's one thing to just make a bad movie. That happens. But this is a lazy movie. There's a part in this movie, it's low budget, I understand that. It still looks good for its budget. But there's a part where, you know how like you're in a haunted house, or maybe like even at Spirit Halloween, and they have those like windows that are like foggy, and on the other side they have like the dark shadowy hands? They use that in this movie. And it is so glaringly obvious. And I'm using that as an example for how lazy this movie is. And that's where I kind of jump out on filmmakers. And I kind of say, I'm done. And I think I might be done with them. This is not on the honor roll Festival of the Living Dead. I did not enjoy this. Maybe you will. It's on Tubi. But I'm just going to tell you, I did not like it. All right, real quick here, because I just watched this one a couple days ago. I want to talk about I'm going to do something positive here, because I feel like I've come across very negative about this batch of films, and I'm really not. Maybe a couple. But Late Night with the Devil is on Shudder now. This came out in theaters a month ago. We have to talk about something up top. And no, it's not the amount of production company logos during the opening of this. There were 9 of them. Yes, I understand this. I've seen this become a thing on social media. Well, guess what? It's not easy to get movies made, especially a movie that is made for about like $1 million, probably, like I read. So, you know what? Yeah. Sorry you had to sit through a minute of production logos. Get over it. You want to see smaller budget horror? You want to see original horror? Then you might have to put up with a couple of production company logos. So, the AI image that comes in, this is a controversy, a dust up. And I think now with some distance, I feel like I'm ready to talk about. I don't like AI art. I am by no means a fan of AI art or really anything. They use an AI image late in the film. I believe it's just one. And if you don't know it, if you don't know it's an AI image, you wouldn't recognize it. But because of the dust up, you may. And it sucks. that it happened, and I think they should be held accountable for it. I think if you give people an inch, they'll take a mile. And I think that's why it's okay to hold filmmakers accountable for stuff like this. But guess what? I think some of the bigger studios, and I think you've already seen it with Disney in that Secret Invasion, they're going to take a mile and more regardless. So I also feel a little sympathy for the filmmakers, because this movie was made a couple years ago and it's been playing festivals, I think, for a year or two now. And that is before all of this current blow up around AI. And I think it's enough to just call them out for it and move on. I think it's counterproductive as horror fans, especially horror fans who claim they want original movies and are tired of sequels, to sit there and say, like, you got to boycott this movie. I saw a lot of that a month ago around this film. And I think that's counterproductive, honestly. And I also think if you're letting it color your feelings toward the movie, you are being unfair to the movie itself. So my opinion is, yeah, you know what? Tell the filmmakers to do better. Tell them it sucks. And then judge the movie on its own merits. I do think I like this movie a lot. This is probably one of my favorite movies of the year, if not my favorite so far. One of the things that works so well about this movie, it's about a late night talk show host, kind of like a Johnny Carson, well, like a secondary Johnny Carson. In the 1970s, he's kind of down, his ratings are down, and he's looking, his wife has just passed from cancer, I believe, and he's looking to kind of juice the ratings, and he was willing to do anything necessary. And I think this is something that touches on something that we're yearning for, especially now with the way media is kind of segmented these days, and it's that shared experience that we don't really have anymore, more outside of like maybe the Super Bowl once a year, maybe some of the, I wouldn't even count elections, maybe some of the bigger news events, but those are news events, like these big cultural moments, because of the way media is and because people watch at different times. Like, the only thing I can think of that's consistent is the Super Bowl, where we all get together and watch the same thing at the same time. And this plays into that, and I think it uses it in some really clever ways. I think David Dismalchin, is excellent in this movie. This movie rests on his shoulders. He's been a character actor for a while. I've always enjoyed his work, but he's had a big couple of years, and I think this is kind of the capper on it. He plays that classic EC Comics Tales from the Crypt style protagonist. He's got that tragic past. He's selling his soul, and he's dabbling in things he shouldn't, all in search of fame, and honestly, all in search of just feeling better. And it's got that, it's good Old Testament Tales from the Crypt style storytelling, because we feel for this character and we want him to do the right thing. But deep down, we know he's not going to. We know he's doomed. This is like, Drag Me to Hell is another movie that does this, another modern-ish movie that does this really, really well. I will say, I think it stretches the gimmick a little bit too far. Towards the end is when I noticed it. I actually didn't notice the first time. There are these backstage segments that kind of play out like you're watching just a regular movie instead of watching a live broadcast. And I think as the movie, it stretches it beyond the point of believability. That's always going to be a risk in movies like this. But like I said, I didn't notice it the first time, and that's how smooth the movie is early on. But that's one negative I'll say about this movie. But man, this is on the honor roll. I really, really enjoyed. I want to revisit this later on because I like this quite a bit. Late Night with the Devil on Shudder now. All right, let's get out of here with Bite. A group of college kids try to help their friend when he discovers a mysterious phone app that turns users into werewolves. This is written and directed by Eddie Lengio. Another Tubi exclusive. So this is, I think, this month, I have watched four. I'm blanking on the names. What was it? Camp Host was one. You Shouldn't Have Let Me In. Those two I actually liked quite a bit. These are Tubi exclusives or originals, movies that Tubi's picked up and put on their service, new movies. I also, as I mentioned, watched Festival of the Living Dead, and this is Bite, another one. I would put this above Festival and below the other two. This is a werewolf movie, which is why I took a shot on it. There are worse movies. I've seen worse werewolf movies. I want to say this, though. If you are making a werewolf movie, focus on the transformation. And I'm going to say no matter your budget. I think when we look back at those the great werewolf movies, like American Werewolf comes to mind in London, not in Paris. But I think what sticks out and what we remember from that movie is the transformation. And I don't think it's a budget hindrance, in my opinion, because even with a low budget, I think you can do a lot with it. And I think Ginger Snaps is a great one. And I think Wolf Cop is another recent one that has a great one. So that's my focus on that instead of kills, because I think the transformation scenes are one of the things that make a great werewolf movie. I don't necessarily, when I think of these movies, like I don't think of the werewolf kills, and Bite focuses on that. Not on the honor roll. There's some fun stuff in it. There's some goofy stuff. I like this app that you prick your finger and you offer blood, and I let the blood drop on the screen. I found enough as gross as it is. I got, like I mentioned, a kitty that's got food and slobber milk all over it. There's a great part where like this dude in a wolf suit like does a 100-meter dash up to an old guy. There's early on, this is one of my favorite low budget things that happens in a movie. So there's like a shot of like the ground and someone's just chucking limbs onto the camera. So yeah, you know what? I had fun with this. I hope the filmmakers keep going, and I hope they keep making movies, because there's some fun stuff in this. But yeah, not on the honor roll, but it's on Tubi. So check it out if you want. That is it for this week. We have some fun stuff out there right now. We've got Tiny Terror on our Patreon. We have also recorded, we're talking about The Walking Dead, the pilot and the final episode. We're doing something called First Episode, Last Episode that I think turns out to be a lot of fun, because I've seen 6 episodes, well, 7 now, of The Walking Dead. Willie has seen quite a bit. So yeah, check that out wherever you get your podcasts. YouTube, if you want to help me keep up with the new horror movies and when they're being released, check it out. YouTube Horror Movie Yearbook. I've been trying to do it weekly, and I've done an okay job of that. And it's going to feed into what I'm doing on here as I watch these movies and talk about them for a little bit. So everybody, thank you very much for listening. And for those who have stuck with us over the past year or so, since we've been a little bit inconsistent with our recording, I just wanted to say thank you again. I'm hoping to keep getting some fun stuff out for the podcast and for all of you as well. We really do appreciate listening. It's awesome. We have anybody listening. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next time.